Special Mideast Migraines Podcast, Part 2. Now the section, The Crisis for Christians. The crisis for Jews stands in poignant parallel to the Christian confrontation with the Nazi Holocaust. Christians, in the very midst of a struggle to come to terms with their relationship to anti-Semitism, must now also confront the complex reality of a Jewish state. Ironically, political Zionism owes its success in part to the Nazi Holocaust, the same catastrophe that has spurred a radical reevaluation of the foundations of Christianity. Historians have noted the influence of a deeply rooted Zionism in Christian Europe in the support for Jewish settlement in Palestine in the 19th and early 20th centuries. So there are two strains within Christianity, one conservative, Christian Zionism, and one liberal/progressive, interfaith reconciliation. Both produce a tendency to support both the concept and the reality of the Jewish state. Both act powerfully to stifle criticism of Israel. This helps explain the reluctance, or phobia might be a better word, of many Christians to call Israel to account for its human rights abuses and its denial of justice to Palestinians. We are presented with a daunting irony. Christians attempting to atone for the crimes committed against the Jews are, by this very fact, blocked from confronting the crimes committed by the Jews. Where does this leave Jews who today find themselves torn between their commitment to religious and racial equality and their loyalty and attachment to the State of Israel? Where does this leave contemporary Christians committed to social justice and their communal endeavors as faith communities? The book will return again and again to these questions. In our own time, with the question of Israel-Palestine only increasing its urgency, what is the proper relationship of the rest of humankind to the Jewish people and to our national homeland project? And what must we do as a Jewish community as we struggle with the agony of our situation in historic Palestine? What is the future we want to create for ourselves?
Thank you. اسطوانات نجمة الشرق الأستاذ رزق الله البناي.
Okay, I really need to race through this now. I'll leave the music on for a tiny bit of background flavor. I'm going to begin chapter 2 of Mark Braverman's Fatal Embrace, Christians, Jews, and the Search for Peace in the Holy Land, 2010, is when the book was published, or released, however they measure it. Chapter 2, it has in some preliminary information, says here, in Chapter 2, I will tell the story of growing up Jewish in post-war America and the crisis of identity and spirit that resulted from my encounter with Israel's occupation of Palestine. Let us begin. Put that on pause. It's not easy to sync both music and talking. Chapter 2, My Journey. Here's a quotation from Dr. Mark Ellis from his work Beyond Occupation. Could we say that the healing of our historical traumas might come about when we see in the faces of the Palestinian people our own faces, bloodied, humiliated, yet bearing a great hope? Here's the beginning of the chapter. I am the grandson of a fifth-generation Palestinian Jew. My grandfather, Joseph Back, was a direct descendant of one of the great Hasidic rabbis of Europe. His family, out of religious zeal, settled in the Jewish quarter of the old city of Jerusalem in the early 19th century. Joseph was born in Jerusalem in the year 1900. An Orthodox Jew, a Palestinian, and a subject of the Ottoman Sultan. As a boy, he played in the narrow stone streets of the old city with Jewish and Arab playmates and prayed in a synagogue built in the shadow of the site of the temple destroyed by the Romans in 70 of the Common Era, 70 CE. As a young man, by most accounts, a bit of a misfit in his pious family, he seized the opportunity to leave the poverty of Jerusalem for the reputedly gold-paved streets of America. His marriage was arranged. My grandmother and her two sisters, first-generation Americans born to a strictly Orthodox Jew, were taken to the Holy Land to find husbands with a suitably devout pedigree. My grandfather met the standard, and they were packed off to America. They settled in the bustling immigrant enclave of South Philadelphia. My mother, their first child, was born 3 months after their arrival in early 1921. In 1945, she married another first-generation American, the charming and handsome son of two of the over 2 million Jewish immigrants who had fled the pogroms of Russia between 1880 and 1924, before U.S. immigration quotas slammed the door shut. I was born in 1948, 1 month before the declaration of the State of Israel. Zionism was mother's milk to me, a Zionism framed in religion. Despite the unusual family history, my experience was far from unique. Any practicing Jew born in America in the post-war years was raised in a religion that was a mixture of political Zionism and rabbinic Judaism. In this quasi-messianic stew, love of the State of Israel was completely intertwined with faithfulness to the commandments. Maps of the new state and photographs of daily life on the collective farms, one hand on the plow, the other on the gun, took their place alongside Bible stories and Hebrew language study in the synagogue classrooms. Zionist folk songs and Israeli military ballads were sung in school assemblies and festival celebrations alongside traditional liturgical tunes. The mythologically tinged history of the Zionist settlement and the history of the State of Israel was as much a part of the curriculum of my Jewish day school education as was study of Jewish ritual and theology. In our prayers, we beseeched God to protect and bless the State of Israel, as in the first flowering of our redemption, in quotes here. I was taught that a miracle, born of heroism and bravery, had blessed my generation. The State of Israel was not merely a historical event. And then in italics, it was redemption. In every generation, so goes the song we would sing every year at the Passover Seder. Tyrants, Pharaoh, Khmelnytsky, Hitler, and of course, Gamal Nasser, the then president, former president of Egypt, rise up to oppress us, and the Lord stretches out his hand to redeem our people. Jewish history was a story of struggle, exile, oppression, and slaughter that had culminated in a homeland again, and at last. I meet my Israeli family. My grandfather may have left the Holy Land, but the heart of the family remained in Jerusalem. Two of Joseph's four children and several grandchildren have emigrated to Israel. My mother's younger sister, Sylvia, was the first, having left for Palestine in 1947 as part of the wave of American Jews committed to the realization of the Zionist dream that was unfolding in the wake of the Nazi Holocaust. For Sylvia, this journey was at least in part a ticket out of the family she never quite felt she belonged to. The older sister, my mother, prim and responsible, while Sylvia was wild, artistic, messy, and rebellious. The brothers, who got the resources and privileges, the stern father, religious and hardworking. The mother, emotionally warm but depleted from the privations of the Great Depression. Sylvia joined Hashomer Hadati, the religious Zionist organization, adopted her Hebrew name, Yaffa, and hopped on a boat to become, in Zionist parlance, a halutza, a pioneer. There she met and married a Czech refugee, one of the few from his family to escape Hitler's Holocaust, and settled down to build the Jewish homeland. It was the summer of 1965. I was 17, sitting on my Aunt Yaffa's back porch in Kfar Haroe, a religious agricultural village on a hill overlooking Israel's coastal plain. A huge domed yeshiva, house of Jewish study, situated at the highest point, dominated the settlement, dotted with citrus groves and simple stucco homes. It was the Israel of the picture books and novels of my childhood. I had come to Israel on the summer youth tour sponsored by the United Synagogue of Conservative Judaism. I had spoken Hebrew with the children in the schoolyard, the shopkeeper in the town, and the farmer in the field. Traveling the mountain road up to Jerusalem, I had seen the burnt-out jeeps from the 1948, and then in quotes he puts, War of Liberation, still maintained as a monument, the burnt-out jeeps, to the battle for the capital, lying by the side of the road approaching the city. I had met my grandfather's brothers, who looked like him, and like me, and were warm and loving to the grandson of the renegade. I was the boy who had, quote, come home. 17 years of religious training and education in language, history, and culture had clicked into place. Proud of the miracle of modern Israel, of what my people had done, creating this vibrant country out of the ashes of Auschwitz. I was in love, deeply, ecstatically. We were sitting together eating a meal. Yaffa, her three children, and I. They were talking about the Arabs. I don't remember the context of the conversation, but I do remember the tone and the attitude. It was the way people talked about black people in the pre-civil rights Philadelphia in which I had grown up. I heard the racism, and I understood the fear that lay just under its surface. I knew there were Arabs in the land. We didn't talk about Palestinians then. But in the story I had been told, they figured only as the enemies who had been defeated in the war and who continued to threaten the security of the young state. And in that moment, I understood that there was more to the story. In that moment, in the midst of my flush of enchantment and delight at the miracle of the Jewish state, and in the midst of the warmest family love I had ever experienced, I knew that there was a problem, a fatal flaw in the Zionist dream. The dream that had produced the storybook land of kibbutzim and cities of white stone and black-hatted men, free to recreate their old world of spirit and study, was built on a shaky foundation, a foundation of denial. There were other people here. They were here when we arrived from the shores of an inhospitable, murderous Europe. I knew this, and I also could see that in this ingathering of my blood, these, quote, others didn't count. And I knew somehow, even then, that this fundamental flaw would grow and ultimately overtake the dream of independence and security. A seed of doubt had been planted, but my attachments to the land stayed strong. Back in the U.S., as a college freshman, I watched the drama of the Six-Day War unfold. That would have been in 1967. and I rejoiced in Israel's victory. David had triumphed again over the Goliath of the Arab nations that sought our destruction. Jerusalem is ours, in quotation. The romance of the land was playing out more powerfully than ever. After college, I lived for a year on a kibbutzim in the Galilee. Ignoring the implications of the pre-1948 Palestinian houses, still in evidence on the kibbutz grounds, and the ancient olive trees standing at the edges of its fields and byways. I could not ignore, however, a meeting with a Palestinian family living down the road, a family displaced when their village, which lay in sight of my kibbutz, was turned into a pile of rubble. They told me the story of their banishment in 1948. They told me that, following their expulsion by Jewish forces, they returned again and again to their homes, despite being told by the Israeli army that their being there was a, quote, security risk. Finally, they told me the village was dynamited. Golda blew up our village, was the way they put it. Golda? My Golda Meir, the hero of my people, along with David Ben-Gurion? My Golda was throwing people out of their homes, stealing their farms, dynamiting their village? Another seed had been planted. Returning home, Israel took a back seat to graduate school, marriage, and raising children. My concerns about Israel increased in direct proportion to the pace of illegal settlement building. Still, I held to the Jewish narrative. The occupation, although lamentably abusive of human rights, was the price of security. The seeds of doubt lay dormant for almost 40 years. Then I went to the West Bank. And we're continuing. I have a few more pages to catch up on here. Once again, what I'm doing with this special edition of Mideast Migraines is rereading what I read live on the air 2 days ago, July 23. I was not able to record that program, so this reading is being recorded for posterity in the form of an eventual upload to my archives. The archives are located at the website radioforall.net. That's radio, the digital character for all.net. Radio for all.net. It'll take me a while to get this this reading replacement recording here uploaded there. And again, I'm reading from Mark Braverman's Fatal Embrace, Christians, Jews, and the Search for Peace in the Holy Land. The book is 6 years old. All right, now, new subheading, The Other Israel. Traveling in Israel in the occupied territories in the summer of 2006, my defenses against the reality of Israel's crimes crumbled. I witnessed the separation wall grabbing huge swaths of Palestinian land, the checkpoints controlling the movement of Palestinians within their own territory and strangling farming, commerce, access to health care, education, and social intercourse. I saw the network of new roads restricted to Israelis. I learned about the assassinations, the midnight raids, and collective punishment. I saw the massive continuing construction of illegal Jewish settlements and towns. I heard firsthand about the vicious acts of ideological Jewish settlers, and words like apartheid and ethnic cleansing sprang to my mind, unbidden and undeniable. That summer, 40 years after my first encounter with the land, I saw all this, and my relationship with Israel changed forever. My last night in Palestine that summer fell on the 9th of Av, A-V, a Jewish day of fasting and mourning, the traditional date of the destruction of the Temple of Solomon, and the beginning of the exile of the Jews 2,000 years ago. The Book of Lamentations, a source text for our liturgy of mourning, attributed by tradition to the prophet Jeremiah, is chanted on that night. It is a harrowing description of a people fallen and traumatized. Here from Lamentations, 1st chapter, 8th verse, 4th chapter, 40, verses 46 through 48, author's translation, Jerusalem has greatly sinned, therefore she has been made a mockery. All who admired her despite her, for they have seen her disgraced. Say that again. All who admired her despise her, for they have seen her disgraced. Sorry. Panic and pitfall are our lot. Death and destruction. My eyes shed streams of water over the brokenness of my poor people. From Lamentations. On that night I sat on a hill overlooking the old city in the company of congregations of praying Jews, mostly American emigres worshiping. I felt at the shrine of their Jerusalem, a Jerusalem, quote, reclaimed at the expense of the Palestinian people. A Jerusalem that for Palestinians is also a spiritual and political center. A Jerusalem that is being taken from them street by street, farm by farm, village by village. I stood on that hill and chanted the words, as I had every year on this day, descriptions of starvation, rape, slaughter, destruction of homes, and banishment from the land, and, for the life of me, I can apply the words only to the Palestinians. In these words, I now felt their suffering, and my eyes shed streams of water for them, my Palestinian brothers and sisters, and yes, for the brokenness of my own people. Two worlds. I had traveled that summer as a delegate with Interfaith Peace Builders, an organization that began as a program of the Fellowship of Reconciliation. FOR, Fellowship of Reconciliation, is an old and fascinating organization. It was founded in 1914 at the outbreak of World War I by an English Quaker and a German Lutheran who, on a railroad platform in Cologne, Germany, committed themselves to working for peace, even as their countries embarked on war. FOR has continued to work for peace and reconciliation everywhere in the world where there is conflict. Interfaith Peace Builders is devoted to building relationships between Israelis, Palestinians, and North American peace activists by sending delegations of North Americans to Israel-Palestine. It was the journey I had been dreaming of for years, and I signed up. That summer I lived in two worlds. I woke up every morning in the home of my Uncle Nate and Aunt Toby in the German colony section of Jerusalem, a neighborhood of stately homes that until 1948 housed well-to-do Palestinian families, now displaced and living in the West Bank or abroad. The neighborhood is now one of the most fashionable in West Jerusalem, and it is peopled entirely by Jews. None of them ever venture into Arab East Jerusalem except for the occasional shopping excursion to the Arab marketplace or religious pilgrimage to the Western Wall, near the site of the Jewish temple destroyed in 70 of the Common Era. Between 1948, when the Jewish forces retreated from the walled Old City in the eastern half of Jerusalem in the face of the Arab Legion, and 1967 when the Israeli army recaptured the eastern side in the Six-Day War, a Berlin-type wall had divided the city. The wall of wood and mortar that had bisected the city was now gone, but the ethnographic barrier remained. I left Jewish West Jerusalem in the morning and walked to the east side to rejoin my delegation for a day of touring and meetings with groups devoted to activism, education, and reconciliation. I cross the street that once marked the boundary wall, and in a surreal, almost magical moment, like a cinematic special effect, I entered another world. With one step, I left Jewish West Jerusalem and entered Arab East Jerusalem. Walking down Saladin Street, I reveled in the sights, sounds, and feel of the place. In contrast to sedate, devout, manicured, and ordered West Jerusalem, East Jerusalem was riotous in color and tempestuous in emotion. Daily, I experienced the vivid contrast between the two cultures. On the one hand, there was the indigenous Palestinian culture, passionate, industrious, wise, connected deeply to the land. On the other was the new Israeli civilization, transplanted from Europe, carved into the ancient landscape, marvelously creative, hardworking, and hungry for life, and ignorant of the people it was displacing. I stopped a distinguished-looking man in traditional Arab dress to ask for directions, and almost began to address him in Hebrew. I had forgotten that I had crossed the invisible barrier that separates Jew from Palestinian. Almost began to address him in Hebrew. For my first 58 years, Jerusalem, in quotes, had been Jewish West Jerusalem. I had now discovered the whole city, and it was split in half. In this divided city, I would have to choose which side I would prefer to live in, which language I would speak. I made this crossing twice every day, eastward in the morning, back west at night. I realized that I was feeling increasingly at home on the east side. I was profoundly disturbed by this feeling. I felt torn apart. What did it mean now to be a Jew? Who was I? The theft of the future. One day our delegation traveled to the Bethlehem area, to the town of Beit Sahur, a splendid West Bank city of homes, small factories, shops, fine churches, and stately mosques spilling up and down the sides of a valley in the hills south of Jerusalem. Along the northern edge of the valley, where once a wooded hillside graced the highest ridge, is Har Homa, an illegal Jewish settlement. Visually, it is an obscenity, a gray, sprawling concrete scar on the landscape. Dominating the valley and the restricted Jewish road linking Jerusalem to Bethlehem, Har Homa links the planned Greater Jerusalem, in quotes, with the fertile area south of Bethlehem that is essentially becoming Jewish Jerusalem's southern suburb. The road marks the boundary of free movement for the Palestinian residents of the valley. Those who cross this road, even by foot, are subject to fines and other punishments or worse. The people of Beit Sahur, prisoners in their own land, sit. Their frustration and anger fester. Footnote to the term, when he talks about Har Homa linking the planned Greater Jerusalem, the phrase Greater Jerusalem, here's the footnote. Following the capture of the West Bank in 1967, Israel illegally annexed East Jerusalem. The ensuing years have seen a systematic and aggressive program of, quote, Judaizing the areas northeast and south of Jewish West Jerusalem. This includes confiscation of Palestinian land for the construction of Jewish-only neighborhoods and suburbs, virtual elimination of all non-Jewish construction, demolition of Palestinian homes, and construction of the separation wall and a system of new Jewish-only roads to create an enclosed Jewish megalopolis accessible only to Jews. The government-sponsored and financed plan for Greater Jerusalem absorbs previously Palestinian areas of settlement north and south of the city and urbanizes agricultural land to the east toward the Jordan Valley. effectively bisecting what remains of the Palestinian West Bank into two separated areas. End of footnote. And now back to the text. Our frustration... Let's start again. Our delegation spent the night as recipients of the hospitality of a number of Beit Sahur's families. This, of course, is the Arab village of Beit Sahur. When my fellow delegate and I arrived at our host's home, I was greeted by Najwa, a warm, gracious woman of about my age, widowed 3 years before our visit. She had a love of life, harvesting the olive grove and herb garden on the plot of land adjoining her home overlooking the city. "This is your home," she said as she greeted us. Awad, her 21-year-old son, reminded me of my son Jacob. Brown curly hair, wide, deep, intense eyes, a tall frame, powerful hands. He was completing a degree in accounting at Bethlehem University. Upon graduation, there would be virtually no chance for a job in occupied Palestine. He did not want to leave his family or his hometown, but I have a future. That night, his friend George visited. George was also 21, a handsome, bright young man, still full of fire and humor. But his mood changed when I asked him what his current pursuits were. George was a gifted computer programmer. When he was still in high school, he moved freely across the Israel-West Bank border to apprentice with Israeli software companies. He was accepted, appreciated, and on his way. After the outbreak of the Second Intifada in 2000, everything changed. Suddenly, the Israelis pulled back. He was no longer welcome in the workplace. George explained, "They treated me as if I were a terrorist. They looked at me as if I had explosives strapped to my chest." The pain in George's eyes was deep. He was hurt, deeply, and stalled. He was going to school to become an accountant, but the enthusiasm was gone. What is left for a 21-year-old who has no sense of a future? And footnote providing a definition for the phrase Second Intifada, Palestinian Uprising. Of course, the Second Palestinian Uprising in modern times. I was deeply upset by my conversations with Awad and George. At dinner with Najwa, her two children, and my fellow delegate, Nicole, I turned to Najwa and said, "The Israelis are scared of you. They don't know you, and they don't want to." Najwa went silent, her eyes sad, acknowledging the truth of my words. Later, I called my aunt in West Jerusalem. Without knowing why, I felt I had to talk to her, and as I spoke to her, I was overtaken by the strength of my feelings. "Oh God, Toby," I said, "we are killing them. We are putting up walls to make them invisible. We are stifling their growth, thwarting their young men, and we just don't seem to care. It's horrible, horrible." The telephone connection to West Jerusalem, fragile at best, cut off as these words left my lips, and as the tears, surprising and unbidden, spilled down my face. But who was this we? I am not an Israeli, but as a Jew, I felt responsible for the actions of this state. Certainly, I became responsible for any continued inaction on my part once I had seen what I had seen, knew what I knew, and felt what I felt. It was not yet clear to me, however, what I was supposed to do. I was deeply torn. This wasn't... I was deeply torn. Wasn't this Israel? The land that was to keep us safe? The dream of millennia? The haven from anti-Semitism? The call to witness, however, is powerful. As I write about the experience of that summer, I find myself thinking about Amira Haas. Israeli peace activist and journalist, a child of Holocaust survivors, who lives in Ramallah in the West Bank, sending weekly dispatches to the Israeli press to tell her fellow Jews the true story of the occupation. Haas credits her mother for showing her the way to her own course of action as a Jew and an Israeli. She tells the story of her mother on a day in 1944, herded from a cattle car into the Bergen-Belsen death camp. As she climbed down from the train, Haas's mother observed a group of German women on bicycles, slowing down to watch with indifferent curiosity on their faces. For me, writes Haas, these women became a loathsome symbol of watching from the sidelines, and at an early age I decided that my place was not with the bystanders. That statement from Amira Haas is found in something written by Mark Ellis, 2004, page 143. Ellis. Okay, now I think I probably even went a little past what I read before in the live broadcast, and I may very well read that section again, that very emotional and striking section, The Theft of the Future, from the second chapter of Mark Braverman's Fatal Embrace. We will complete chapter 2 next Saturday, which is going to be the 30th day of this month, July 30, at 11 a.m. Pacific here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, streaming live, hopefully, then, at freakradio.org and broadcasting to the city of Santa Cruz, California, on the central left coast, at 101.3 FM on the radio dial. Till then, or which will be the next edition of Mideast Migraines, trading off with this other weekly time slot of Mondays Pacific Time, 1500 hours, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Until then, there you go. You now have this recorded reading of Chapter 1 and the first part of Chapter 2. I'm Ren Tawil. Thank you for listening. So long, folks.